Lisa's passion for piano and exposed her to the fine arts. From both, Rice learned the value of faith in the face of hardship and the importance of giving back to the community. Extraordinary, Ordinary People, a memoir of family written and narrated by Condoleezza Rice. Starting Monday at noon and Tuesday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 31 with fog. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 30s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 40s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some articles from the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Gunsmoke, the complete series. There have been television westerns almost since the first TV sets rolled off the assembly line, but few have achieved the acclaim of Gunsmoke by David Hofstede. Was it the best ever? That will trigger a spirited debate among fans defending classics as diverse as The Lone Ranger and Deadwood. But as the longest-running TV western, Gunsmoke's reign is unchallenged and will likely never be approached. It was September 10, 1955, when viewers first met U.S. Marshal Matt Dillon, James Arness, Long Branch saloon proprietor Miss Kitty Russell, Amanda Blake, physician Galen Doc Adams, Milburn Stone, Deputy Chester Good, Dennis Weaver, and other denizens of Dodge City, Kansas. The series remained a staple in the CBS lineup for the next 20 years, ending on March 31, 1975. Gunsmoke, the complete series, collects all 625 episodes, uncut, from all 20 seasons, on 143 DVDs. Forget clearing a shelf. You may need to clear a room. But for television this good, it's worth finding the space. Okay, I've got it. Now, where should I start? Good question. Ben Costello has the answer. Those who purchased previous Gunsmoke DVD season sets enjoyed commentary on selected episodes from Costello, author of Gunsmoke, an American Institution, celebrating 50 years of television's best western. Few fans know the series as well. He grew up watching it, has spent decades collecting Gunsmoke memorabilia, and spent more than 5 years completing his book, which offers commentary on every episode. If you're a longtime fan or a new viewer and are not sure how to begin diving into 20 seasons worth of shows, Costello recommends these 5 episodes as examples of Gunsmoke at its best. Matt Gets It, Season 1, Episode 1. The show's debut episode was introduced by John Wayne, who had recommended James Arness for the role of Marshal Dillon. As the story opens, Matt is nearly shot to death when he tries to apprehend a notorious gunfighter. A couple more inches, and this series would have had a shorter run than Tim Conway's Rango. Costello, I could give you 5 great episodes or more from every season, but we still have to start from the beginning. Here, the villain is quicker than the lawman on the draw. That didn't usually happen to the heroes in westerns. Sins of the Father, Season 2, Episode 17. Big Dan Daggett, Peter Whitney, and his Indian bride Rose, Angie Dickinson, are passing through town and check into the Dodge House. The locals discover that Rose's father led attacks on white settlers and vow revenge. Costello. This is an excellent episode directed by Andrew McLagan with a timely message about prejudice and hatred. Angie Dickinson is marvelous as the Indian wife. Chester Land, Season 7, Episode 8. The beautiful Miss Daisy, Sandra Blake, agrees to marry Chester if he can provide a proper home. So Chester begins to build a little house on the prairie, and everything that can go wrong does. Costello. When I interviewed Dennis Weaver, I told him his performance reminded me of the great silent film comedian Buster Keaton. Gold Train, The Bullet, Season 17, Episodes 12 through 14. Matt has a bullet lodged near his spine, and Doc doesn't want to risk performing an operation to remove it. They put the marshal on a train so he can see a specialist, and the train is held up by a gang led by guest star Eric Braden. Costello. This was a return episode for Milburn Stone, who had been off the series for a while after he had bypass surgery. There's also a great performance by Amanda Blake in a scene where she talks to Matt about the love she felt for him throughout the years. This is the show's only three-part episode, and it could have been a movie. And finally, Hostage, Season 18, Episode 13. Jude Bonner, William Smith, seeks vengeance after Matt arrests Bonner's brother, who is sentenced to hang. He exacts his revenge not on Matt, but on Miss Kitty, brutalizing her and shooting her in the back as she staggers back to the Long Branch Saloon. Doc takes care of her, and Matt stays by her bedside until he knows she'll recover. Then he takes off his badge and sets out to find Jude Bonner. Costello. This episode came out of the same year as The Cowboys, and just like Bruce Dern got hate mail for shooting John Wayne in the back, William Smith received a lot of hate mail for shooting Miss Kitty. Best of the Big Screen West. Take 4 to celebrate films, filmmakers, and film stars of special interest to CNI readers. We're presenting the 4th annual edition of the CNI Movie Awards. Vote for your favorites at cowboysindians.com/movieawards by Joe Layden. Much like the organizers of most other movie awards during the year of COVID-19, we've had to make some adjustments to our voting process. Because we traditionally limit the list of qualified films to those that receive at least limited theatrical and or festival exposure. And to be honest, during 2020, some of that exposure was extremely limited. We have 4 nominations in each category instead of the usual 5. On the other hand, we've added a brand new category this year, Best Documentary. That's where you'll find 4 exceptional nonfiction features that focus on the first wife of the legendary Johnny Cash, Matt Riddlehoover's My Darling Vivian, the creative processes of music, City, Toon Smith's It All Began with the Say Songs, the story of the Nashville songwriter, the challenging lives of contemporary cowboys, Bud Force and John Longmire's Cowboys, a documentary portrait, and the musical tastes of our 39th U.S. President, Murray Wharton's Jimmy Carter, Red and Rock and Roll President, which, despite its title, also includes testimonials from country artists like Willie Nelson, Larry Gatlin, and Garth Brooks. Of course, it wouldn't be a CNI Movie Awards celebration if our readers didn't have the final word in the selection process. So we're asking you to visit cowboysandindians.com and cast your vote for your favorite in each category. We're also seeking your nominations for the greatest Western film of all time. You'll be able to write in your all-time favorite, and we'll be revealing an updated ranking of classic Westerns later this year. The deadline for submitting your picks in the CNI Movie Awards will be Wednesday, March 3rd. Winners will be announced Friday, March 5th. Vote at cowboysindians.com/movieawards. Vote now. Among the dramatic features with multiple nominations are five movies. First Cow, a critically acclaimed period drama from Mech's Cutoff director Kelly Reichardt about two improbably matched partners who hit upon a novel way to milk opportunities and make their fortune in the 19th century Oregon Territory. Let Him Go. CNI reader faves Kevin Costner and Diane Lane star to perfection in Thomas Bazooka's slow burn thriller as a Montana couple driven to extremes while trying to retrieve their grandchild from an off-the-grid clan in the Dakotas. News of the World. Tom Hanks reunites with Captain Phillips director Paul Greengrass for the Oscar-winning actor's first Western, the story of a Civil War veteran who signs on to return a youngster, Helena Zingle, raised by Kiowa to her biological family. Nomadland, for her follow-up to The Rider, director Chloe Zhao offers another masterful entwining of fact and fiction while focusing on a strong-willed woman, two-time Oscar winner Frances McDormand, who packs her van and begins a nomadic life in the American West. And Yellow Rose, a Filipina teen, Eva Noblezada, in Bastrop, Texas, develops a taste and talent for country music and winds up being mentored by veteran country artist Dale Watson, played in a bold stroke of casting by Dale Watson in Diane Paraga's contemporary drama. Here are the nominees. Best Picture, First Cow, Let Him Go, News of the World, Nomadland. Best Director, Thomas Bazooka, Let Him Go, Paul Greengrass, News of the World, Kelly Reichardt, First Cow, Chloe Zhao, Nomadland. Best Actor, Kevin Costner, Let Him Go, Tom Hanks, News of the World, Harrison Ford, The Call of the Wild, John Magaro, First Cow. Best Actress, Eva Noblezada, Yellow Rose, Diane Lane, Let Him Go, Frances McDormand, Nomadland, Helen Zinga, News of the World. Best Supporting Actor, Gary Farmer, First Cow, Orion Lee, First Cow, David Strathairn, Nomadland, Dale Watson, Yellow Rose. Best Supporting Actress, Kaylee Carter, Let Him Go, Leslie Manville, Let Him Go, Linda May, Nomadland, Princess Punzalan, Yellow Rose. Best Screenplay, Thomas Bazooka, Let Him Go, Paul Greengrass and Luke Davies, News of the World, Kelly Reichardt and Jonathan Raymond, First Cow, Chloe Zhao, Nomadland. And Best Documentary, Cowboys, a Documentary Portrait. It all begins with a song, the story of the Nashville songwriter, Jimmy Carter, rock and roll president, and finally, My Darling Vivian.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading some articles from True West magazine. Today, we're on True West's website and going way back into their earlier editions. This article we're about to read comes from their April 1973 edition of True West. Black Jack Ketchum tried to give me a break. From the unpublished memoirs of a man who, by a last-minute statement of the doomed outlaw, was cleared of complicity in the Steins Pass robbery. Dust whipping around the Sulphur Springs Valley horizon has long ago obliterated old trails. Covered, too, are the hoof prints of the cowboys who rode shooting and shouting through the streets of Wilcox, Arizona. When the wind is quiet and the blue water shimmers in the dry lake beds of the Wilcox Playa, distant mirages to mystify the traveler, could it be that the single cloud of dust on the great flat expanse is a dust devil? Or could it be reckless riders headed for a Saturday night in town? Located on the main Al Hoot Trail between Dodge City and points of no return farther west, Wilcox was a choice location for cowhands with a yen for easier cash than their 30 and found wages. The railroads coming in 1880 gave the town birth, and it was along the railroad that brought notoriety along with passengers and mail. Train robbery became rather routine in the 1890s, and some of the outlaws wore sheriff's badges. The Steins Pass train robbery in the fall of 1897 resulted in the arrest of several Sulphur Springs cowboys. One, Walter Hovey, chronicled their experiences in avoiding the hangman's noose while spending 6 years in New Mexico jails. According to newspaper accounts, four masked men boarded the westbound Southern Pacific train at Steins Pass and compelled the engineer to stop the train, 2 miles beyond the station. A bonfire had been built at this location where other outlaws were waiting. Shots were fired into the express car. Detective Jenkins of Wells Fargo killed one of the gang and the others fled on horseback. Another of the robbers is believed to be wounded. The dead robber is believed to be Edward H. Cullen, who is known to have been in Bisbee not long ago. The train had a heavy list of passengers, most of whom were crouched under the seats, terrified at this initiation to the Wild West. Hovey set the date for the Steins Pass train robbery in November, although some newspapers give the month as December. In 1939, Hovey sent his memoirs to Mrs. Mary Kidder Rack, after reading some of her books in a Portland, Oregon library. Mrs. Rack had written Mountain Cattle and Cowman's Wife, stories about ranch life in Cochise County. The Racks owned the Hell's Hip Pocket Ranch in the range country north of Douglas. In writing to her, he explained, "Your stories are centered around a territory with which, at one time, I was familiar. That territory was home to me for a time. Fort Rucker, Tex Canyon, High Lonesome, San Simon, White River, all of these names and many more serve to revive memories and has created within me an almost burning desire to learn something of what became of those whom I called my friends. At the time I was in Arizona, I was little more than a boy, a product of the frontier with little training and no restraining. I was associated at times with some pretty rough characters, and, boy-like, assumed that this was the manly thing to do. The Wild Bunch, who used to haunt the Chiricahuas and other mountain ranges in Cochise County, swinging wide loops to establish herds from maverick cattle, are an extinct breed. Walter Hovey, one of these early-day cowboys, left his home in Kansas at the age of 14. He was born in 1872. I had been outside man for the San Simon Cattle Company. I put my own brand, WBC, on a few mavericks, but I can truthfully say that I never put my brand upon a calf following another man's cow, Hovey stated. There were quite a few outlaws of varying degree in Cochise County. There was Code Young, Bob Hayes, Jess Williams, Ed Mason, Dave Atkins, Bill Carver, Sam and Tom Ketchin, Ed Cullen, Jack Harper, and many more. I believe most were my friends. I was anxious to have their goodwill because I wanted to stay in this country and live. I never gave a posse a clue to their whereabouts, and I gained the enmity of officers by my refusal. This nearly caused the early demise of myself and some of my other cowboy friends. None of us was in any way connected with the Steins Pass train robbery, and none of us that November morning at the Tex Ranch had any knowledge of the holdup until we were surrounded by a posse of 23 breeds. Throughout his letters to Mrs. Rack and threading his memoirs was a bitterness toward the lawmen he knew in Cochise County and in New Mexico. Bert Alvord, a sheriff at Wilcox, earned his hatred for a very personal reason, as he relates. Alvord had his gang, and they would go out and knock over a payroll, bank, or train, or some lonely wayfarer who had a role. Then organize a posse and go out to hunt for the robbers, sometimes bringing in the criminal, in quotes, dead. I feel that he should have been decapitated for the cruel murder of Billy King in Wilcox in 1897. I was not in town at the time of this murder, yet in a way, I have always known how it came about. A few weeks before this affair, I had been in Wilcox helping in a cattle shipment. During the afternoon of the day we had finished loading out the herd, I became embroiled in a fight with a man with whom I had previously been on very friendly terms. A shot was fired, but there was no damage done, and apparently everyone had forgotten the occurrence. Later, about 15 or 20 of us went into a bar and were having a friendly drink, when suddenly I was whisked to my feet by a large Mexican deputy and a man by the name of Walker, who ran a barber shop. Of course, I put up a struggle, and jerking one gun free, I struck the Mexican in the face. Billy King had been standing near me, and he rushed forward and disarmed Walker. The Mexican and Walker both claimed to be deputies and demanded my arrest. Not liking the idea of being locked up, I asked them to set some kind of bond until I could be brought before the justice of the peace. Since the JP was in the gathering crowd, he told the deputies to release me on a $50 cash bail. I am merely relating this circumstance in order to show just what set off the hatred of Deputy Alvord for Billy King. King had gone to Wilcox and was in Rom's Saloon, a large frame building with a double door at the entrance in front and another door leading out the rear. There was a high board fence which joined onto the back of the building, extending into the alley. Alvord walked into the front of the saloon and, in passing King, touched his shoulder, saying, "I would like to speak to you a moment." He never checked his stride, and King turned from the bar and followed him. Alvord opened the rear door and then stepped back so that King could walk out first. As he pulled the door shut behind him, he drew his gun. Not a word was spoken, but five shots rang out in rapid succession from Alvord's army Colt. Three of them entered King's back and neck. The two others were through his head and his side. It was the click of the latch on the gate in that same alley that prevented me from meeting the same fate, and by Alvord just 12 days preceding the shooting of King. Later, I learned that Alvord boasted he would get King and me both the first time we came into town. He made good on his threat about King, and I took a solemn vow that I would make him pay for his worthless life, a vow that I was never able to make good because of rapidly changing events, meaning Hovey's arrest for the Steins Pass train robbery. I had ridden into town and tied my horse in front of the saloon and walked in. The bartender announced, "Alvord has made a new ruling. You'll have to unbuckle your gun belt and leave it here behind the bar while you are in town." I thought a minute and almost decided to ride out, but thinking better of it, I handed over my gun and walked back to the card tables. In a few minutes, Alvord swaggered through the front door, walking quite fast as he passed me and touched me on the shoulder, saying, "I want to speak to you a moment." He didn't stop, but continued on to the back door, which was open, and I immediately followed. Three doors down from the saloon was the barber shop run by Walker. Alvord stopped behind this shop and stepping to one side left me facing the alley gate to it. Then he said, Walker has left town. He has heard that you were in and that you had bragged that you were going to kill him. Through a crack in the fence, I sighted a slight movement and the form of a man holding a shotgun or rifle. Instantly, I said, Bert, I have never made a threat against Walker. And I had never done so, but I knew that this was no private conversation. Alvord replied, I have heard that you did say so, and, as he stopped talking, shifted his gaze to the West Street entrance. A large colored woman had snapped the hook back and was entering. She had in her hands a tray of food, covered over with a white cloth. Coming toward us, she said cheerfully, Howdy do, Mr. Bert. Her voice was the sweetest I have ever heard as she came directly to us and started a conversation with Alvord. I turned and walked back to the saloon, expecting every moment to hear a challenge. None came. I was shaken as I asked for my gun, and as I buckled it on, Alvord walked in the back door. Come and have a drink with me, he said as he joined me. We drank, and then without a word, he turned and walked out the front door. I too went out, mounted my horse, and rode back to camp. I tried then to warn Billy King, but could not reach him in time. Hovey was known as Walter Hoffman in Cochise County, a name he says was wished on him by Charlie Cook, who was a nephew of Jimmy Cook, manager of the Three Bar Cattle Company in Sulphur Springs Valley. Mrs. Rack corresponded with Hovey for a time, but did not put his story into a book as he had wished, but advised him to go ahead and write it himself. And she did nothing with the material he sent to her until years later, in 1954, when she passed it on to me to do something with. Mrs. Rack died soon after. The Hovey papers have remained in my possession just as Mrs. Rack left them. Recently, it occurred to me that Walter Hovey's story might be of interest to the readers of True West. Doris Sturges. Memories of outstanding circumstances in our lives may be buried deep within us, but try as we may, it is not possible to entirely forget. Passing events, changing attitudes, or some small incident may revive the past, so that there may be all but a spontaneous outburst of our inner being. And then we will reveal secrets which we fully intended to carry into the great unknown. I was a product of the Great West, the Old West, and in those early days, I knew some of the bad men. Some were outlaws by choice, while others were driven to it by the type of law officials, such as the Earp brothers. Others like them were Jack Love, Tom Odom, Date Graham, and Pat Garrett. Garrett was the notorious slayer of William Bonney, better known as Billy the Kid. They were fully capable of killing for the posted reward, claiming that they had shot in self-defense. On the other side of the ledger, there were those officers with the highest degree of honor and courage, such as Sheriff McGee of Canadian City, Texas, Scott White of Tombstone, Arizona, and Jim Herring of Beaver City, Oklahoma, and many more. In those early days, it was not customary nor good policy to become too personal in the matter of asking a stranger his name or where he hailed from. Rather, it was to accept each and all alike. When I worked for the Anchor D Cattle Company in what was known as the Neutral Strip or No Man's Land of Oklahoma, there was no law except for the 45 Colts and vigilante committees. I left that country in 1889 and landed in Higgins, Texas, where I worked for the Box T Cattle Company. If my memory serves me correctly, it was in 1892 or 93 that I met and became acquainted with Will Rogers. He rode out to the Box T and stayed several days, and I was very impressed with his pencil sketches and his droll manner in spinning yarns. I took part in the big race in both the Cheyenne and the Cherokee Strip when they were thrown open to settlement. Then I drifted into southern Arizona, where I embarked on a small scale in the horse and cattle business. Arizona was inhabited by large ranching interests, and there was quite extensive mining. Many of the old-time punchers carried about as much artillery as the outlaw, so it wasn't easy to distinguish the vocation of a man by first glance. The appearance of heavily armed strangers was generally the giveaway of a bank robbery or something of the sort. These posses were usually composed of around a half dozen Americans and 15 to 20 Mexicans and Indians. These posses were far more dangerous at your camp than the outlaws themselves. One brush between officers and outlaws occurred shortly after the Nogales bank robbery of 1896, when a posse trailed the robbers across the Sulphur Springs Valley and the San Simon into the Skeleton Canyon, where the outlaws doubled back to form an ambush cave, and when the officers suddenly encountered them in the deep rocks. The outlaws were the original Black Jack, Bob Hayes, Code Young, Jess Williams, and another that I don't recall. Sheriff Leathergood led the posse, composed of 22 members. One was Bill Hildreth, a cowpuncher who had often tried to be friendly with Black Jack's bunch to gain their confidence. The outlaws planned to kill him, and when they found he was in the posse, they concentrated their fire on him. Sheriff Leathergood was killed, and several horses were shot from under their riders. Posse members never fired a shot, and oddly enough, Hildreth escaped down a canyon. The mouth of Skeleton Canyon was only 3 miles from the San Simon horse camp, and I assisted the officers in removing the body of the sheriff from the canyon. Leathergood didn't know the country and had placed too much confidence in Hildreth, who led the company into the ambush. Within a few weeks, Williams and Young were shot and killed at the A Ranch by a party of officers. Black Jack's horse was shot from under him, but he managed to get away. The Chiricahua Mountains seemed to provide the safest hiding places for the outlaws. I believe it was on the 9th of November, 1897, that a Southern Pacific train was held up at Steins Pass, New Mexico, by 6 men. They boarded and took possession, forcing the engineer and fireman to run it a few miles past the hamlet. There was supposed to be a large consignment of gold and currency aboard. A number of guards, headed by Jeff Milton, were on the train to protect the shipment. All were armed with 30-30 caliber Winchester rifles and sawed-off shotguns. The battle was on, and according to crew and passengers, it raged for some 45 minutes before the guards routed the would-be robbers. They left behind the body of Ed Cullen, riddled with buckshot. There was at this time a posse of 20 or more encamped at Bowie, Arizona, which was about 35 miles west of Steins Pass. They had been congregating for several days, preparing for a trip down into the Chiricahuas and Swisshelm Mountains, where they planned to round up a band of around 30 outlaws with prices on their heads, totaling $9,000. The attack on the train galvanized them into action. At that time, there was a standing reward, dead or alive, for mail or train robbers. My headquarters at this time was in the Hunt Canyon in the Swiss Helms, about 3 miles from the 7-Up Ranch. There were 3 partners in the cattle business at Tex Canyon, about 7 miles distant. Their names were Albertson, Waterman, and Vintage. Hardworking and honest, they had the respect of everyone who knew them. Tex Canyon was around 120 miles southwest of Steins Pass, and Silver Creek was another 20 miles southwest of Tex Canyon, and about 6 miles north of the Mexican border. Waterman, Vintage, Albertson, and myself had planned for some time to work the Silver Creek country to round up strays to keep them out of Mexico. It so happened that Vintage could not go with us, and so the rest of us set out with our pack horses for a 3-day trip. We made a late camp, and shortly thereafter, we saw 3 riders driving 4 pack animals before them. They had also seen us and stopped. After a few minutes, one of them rode over to our camp, and we learned that our suspicions were correct. They were Mexican smugglers headed for the mining camp of Bisbee. Satisfying themselves that we were not officers, they asked to eat supper with us. We learned that they were carrying a varied assortment of contraband, including mezcal, whiskey, and opium. Later in the evening, with most of us more or less intoxicated, we decided to hijack them for at least a portion of the whiskey. In the fight that followed, I was shot, and the Mexicans took their leave. Albertson and Waterman were making arrangements to take me back to the Tex Ranch, checking on the flow of blood and assisting me onto my horse. We arrived back at the ranch the following morning. James Hunsacker, who with his parents owned the cattle ranch to the north on White River and near Old Camp Rucker, rode by and visited until dinner. Tom Capehart, highly respected Diamond, a cowpuncher, came by and spent the night. Then the following day, November 11th, Henry Marshall of the Erie Cattle Company rode up about 9 a.m. An hour later, the ranch was surrounded by a posse of officers from Bowie Station, 16 in all. They made camp until the next day and then informed us that they were taking us in for the Steins Pass train robbery, which up until then, none of us had heard about. After confiscating all of the firearms and ammunition at the ranch, the posse would walk one of us at a time down the canyon to hold a court of inquiry. They would yell and fire their six-shooters at our heads, vilifying and insulting us. They struck Tom Capehart in the face and over the head with a gun and jabbed him in the stomach with a cocked .45 Colt. There was never any doubt but that for one member of the posse, Ciprana Baca, we would have lost our lives then and there. If any of these men are murdered, I will kill the officer who fired the shot, he declared. Being unable to walk, I had not been taken out for questioning. The bullet at Silver Creek had been through the right leg, but I didn't escape the grilling and was particularly questioned about my leg wound. Sometime in the afternoon, we were advised that we were under arrest, but we weren't told for what reason. We were loaded into a wagon pulled by a team of mules, and we started for what they said was San Simon Station, about 60 miles away. We traveled all night and arrived at our destination at around 8 a.m. Those of us arrested included all who were at the ranch with the exception of John Vintage, who was arrested some 9 weeks later. That night we were taken by train to Tucson, and the next morning we had our hearing before the U.S. Commissioner. We were formally charged with train robbery in the territory of New Mexico. We waived extradition and that night were started on our way to Silver City in Grant County. Upon our arrival on November 7th, we were greeted by a large crowd. Of course, I could never blame them for their curiosity at the cowboy strangers they accepted as train robbers. He was shot in the train holdup, one was heard to say. And another declared, they will probably hang him too. Too bad, and he is only a kid. This last remark made me think of a conversation I had with a man by the name of Tom O'Keefe in Arizona some months before. There were lots of maverick cattle, and the country was wild and rough. Anyone rounding up mavericks had to be a good mountain man and handy with a rope. That was me, and I made a habit of branding them alternately, one for the man I was working for and one for myself. O'Keefe was a small rancher on White River, and I had happened to meet him one day while riding. I didn't tell him who I was, but I recognized him by the huge brand on his horse. We talked of several things, and finally, he asked me if I knew Walter Hoffman, meaning me. And he continued, he plans to make his living by Jesus at the end of a rope, and I'm a-thinking that the bugger will die that way too. Now, I was beginning to wonder if O'Keefe's words that sunny day in Cochise County might not be prophetic. Silver City, situated in the extreme Midwest of New Mexico, was at one time in the heart of the silver mining operations. The territorial grand jury convened around the 10th of January, and Leonard Albertson, F. L. Capehart, John Marshall, and myself were speedily indicted, charged with attempted train robbery. We had not been allowed to communicate or to secure counsel, and it appeared that we would need some, since the sheriff had brought in a bevy of carpenters to look over the scaffold, which had been dismantled some years before. I had not at any time thought that any of us would be executed, simply because I could not conjure such a picture. From the day of our arrival at the Silver City Jail, there had been two extra guards on duty, day and night. They carried sawed-off shotguns. The night guard, an old Irish gentleman by the name of Rose, showed a degree of friendliness, and I asked him if there was a good lawyer in the city. He agreed to send one to see me. The following afternoon, a man came to my door and introduced himself as James Fielder. I was soon convinced that I could place my fate in his hands. I addressed a communication to my five friends, whom I had not seen since our arrival. Fielder visited each of them, and we engaged him as our joint counsel. Judge Frank Parker was on the bench when our case came to trial, and the U.S. prosecuting attorney, W.B. Childress, battled for our conviction. There were 42 witnesses in all who came from Arizona to testify in our behalf. Not to be outdone, the prosecution produced 52 witnesses, all the posse members, train crew, and many that we had never seen before. There were so many fantastic statements made that the thought occurred to me, by jacks, maybe I was in that holdup, and it has simply slipped my memory. The jury of 9 Americans and 3 Mexicans returned a verdict of not guilty. Never before or since have I witnessed such utter dejection in that courtroom by the posse who had made this gigantic capture of train robbers. They had counted on the $5,000 reward for each of us. The grief was not only confined to them, but to one, Date Graham, a newly appointed town marshal from Bisbee, who had volunteered himself as an expert perjurer. After a lapse of so many years since that time, it hardly seems possible that these individuals have escaped the wrath or bullets of some honest man. There are thousands of men who can testify from sad experience that there are those who would not hesitate to swear away your life or liberty for a few dollars or renown. However guilty of other things I may have been, I knew that I and my friends were not guilty of this charge of train robbery. Yet our elation at being declared not guilty was short-lived, and we were again locked up. A bond of $10,000 was set for each of us under a charge of interfering with U.S. postal laws, and in holding up a train, a charge that we had just been proven innocent of. The prosecutor had the case transferred to Las Cruces, where we were held for months in a huge adobe dungeon with but one door and no windows. Among all the known vermin and filth were the bed bugs, lice, and mosquitoes. Never for a moment were we permitted to forget our terrible misery in sweet, quiet rest. We could not wash our hands and face unless we used our cup of drinking water for this purpose. The only ray of light came through the steel-barred door. The heat was intense, yet the pieces of filthy blanket lying on the floor were damp to the touch. The thought occurred to me that since the human vultures had failed to decapitate us, they had then adopted this method of extermination. But soon I would think, no, it cannot be their intent to kill us, for twice each day the guards shove our daily rations through the bars. For breakfast, we would have frijoles and tortillas, and sometimes later in the day, we would have tortillas and frijoles. The sheriff, who was also the manager of this torture chamber, was none other than the notorious Pat Garrett. It had been said that the nature of some mankind is similar to that of the wolf. The difference is that man conceals his true nature behind studied smiles and semi-civilized veneer. At last, the date of our second trial was set, and regardless of the outcome, we were more than glad, for we could not much longer endure Pat Garrett's jail. Then whatever hope we might have had for a speedy acquittal was dispelled when we took one look of the jury of long-haired, seamy, greasy faces. Most of the efforts of our attorney, Fielder, were overruled, and it seemed that nothing could be done in our behalf. Jim Fielder had exhausted more than half of his challenges when he turned and whispered to me, "What is the use? Pat Garrett controls every Mexican in Dona Ana County." Not one of the jurors could speak or understand the English language, and most could neither read nor write. All testimony went through an interpreter, and the answer to most questions asked of them was, "Me no savvy." All of our former witnesses who attended the first trial at Silver City were there to give their testimony in our behalf, including Scott White, sheriff of Tombstone, Arizona. It was apparent before the proceedings began that it would be a folly to delay the outcome, whatever it might be. The entire trial seemed to be on the principle of heads I win, tails you lose. A throw of the dice would have been safer. Never have I heard a more impassioned plea than our attorney made on our behalf, although most of the jurymen were looking out the window. But to the final plea of the eloquent prosecutor, Childress, they were all eagerness, nodding their heads and nudging one another. At last, Judge Frank Parker read his final instructions. The verdict was that Henry Marshall, Tom Capehart, and John Vintage were not guilty. Leonard Albert, William Waterman, and I were found guilty as charged, and we were given a sentence of 10 years in the Santa Fe, New Mexico prison, together with a fine of $10,000 each. 10 years! It seemed impossible to grasp the significance. I tried to think back in my life to recall occurrence of 10 years in the past. I had run away from home 11 years before at the age of 14. We were marched back to our dungeon, and soon Marshall, Capehart, and Vintage had gathered up their small possessions, and we bade them a fond and long adieu. We were glad to see them go for their sake. Their 17 months of imprisonment had impaired their health. All had been so strong and healthy, used to living in the open with plenty of good food. I never communicated with or heard from them again. Attorney Fielder said that he would never cease trying to gain our release and for us to try to make the best of a bad situation. We were whisked away to the penitentiary, convicted of a crime we didn't do. Stringing up by the thumbs and standing for hours at a time with hands chained to a ring above the head, were done away with. We had been at Santa Fe for about 2 years when William Walters, better known as Bronco Bill, was ambushed by officers in Arizona. His right arm had been shot off, and he was captured and brought to prison. Shortly after his capture, he made a statement that he, Ed Cullen, who was killed at Stein's Pass train holdup, Bill Carver, Dave Atkins, and Sam and Tom Ketchin were responsible for the train holdup. Not long after Bronco Bill's arrest, Sam Ketchum was captured. Mortally wounded, he died the following day after being brought to prison. Within a few days of this, Black Jack, Tom Ketchum, held up a mail train in northern New Mexico and shot a mail clerk. Although shot in the arm by the conductor, he managed to get away to his horse before he fell, weakened by loss of blood. His arm was amputated, and he was brought to prison until the date could be set for his trial. At the trial, he exonerated Waterman, Albertson, and myself of any implication in the Stein's Pass robbery. He named the men who had participated with himself. His statement was made to a number of officials, including W.B. Childress, who was also his prosecutor. Yet nothing was done, and except for an article published in the different papers as to the statement by Black Jack and by Bronco Bill earlier, I never heard anything about it again. Black Jack was a very fine-looking specimen of a man. He was around 6 feet 2 inches in height and large in proportion, with coal black hair and a rather dark complexion. The times I had seen him in Arizona, he seemed quite reserved and not giving to braggadocio. He was a man of strong determination and seemed utterly devoid of fear. He always carried a .45 Colt buckled around his waist, and I never saw him without his Winchester in his hand or lying across his lap. The second time I ever met him was at the old Up Ranch in Arizona, when he and his brother Sam rode up around noon and had dinner with us. Sometime later, he asked if I would cut his hair, which then had almost reached his shoulders. The day was very warm, and we repaired to the shady side of the house, and I proceeded to my task. He was seated upon a chair with no back and with his rifle across his knees. After finishing the hair cutting, he asked me to shave the back of his neck, and when I did so, he told me that there was an opportunity to make $9,000. I told him I didn't have any use for that kind of money. Tom Blackjack Ketchum was executed at Clayton, New Mexico on April 26, 1901. For this, I had the word of A.W. Ayers, a Santa Fe railroad engineer who was also a photographer. For this last reason, Ayers invited me to the execution. Ayers told me that there were 68 guests at the hanging. I obtained pictures from him, taken both before and after the execution. One shows Blackjack walking to the scaffold and of the sheriff adjusting the noose. Also, just before the drop and then afterward, with two or three deputies standing beside the body as it laid on the ground. They looked exultingly into the eyes of the camera with their wide sombreros pushed to the back of their heads. The 9-foot drop had completely severed the head from the body. Although hanging was legal, the manner in which it was done was far from being any credit to the territory of New Mexico or to any of the officials who participated. Before going to his death, Ketchum dictated the following letter to the President of the United States. Clayton, New Mexico, April 26, 1901. To His Excellency, the President of the United States, Washington, D.C. Sir, being now at the town of Clayton, New Mexico, awaiting my execution, which is set for this day, and realizing the importance to the liberty of other men and duty which I conceive to be incumbent upon myself, standing in the presence of death, where no human aid can reach me, I desire to communicate with you by this letter some facts which I deem to be of interest to the people through their president and perhaps by the means of liberating innocent men. There are 3 men in the Santa Fe prison serving sentences for the robbery of the United States mail at Steins Pass, New Mexico in 1897. They are Leonard Albertson, Walter Hoffman, and Bill Waterman. They are as innocent of the crime as an unborn baby. The names of the men who did commit the crime are Dave Adkins, Ed Cullen, Will Carver, Sam Ketchum, Bronco Bill, and myself. I have given to my attorney in Clayton means by which articles taken in said robbery may be found, where we hid them, and also the names of the witnesses who live in that vicinity, both immediately before and after the robbery. The fact that these men are suffering impels me to make this confession to prove their innocence. While you cannot help me, and while I realize that all efforts to secure me a commutation of my sentence have significantly failed, I wish to do this much in the interests of these innocent men, who, as far as I know, never committed a crime in their lives. I make this statement fully realizing that my end is fast approaching and that I must very soon meet my Maker. Very respectfully, your servant, T. E. Ketchum. On April 29, 1901, the Associated Press published the following report. Washington. The Department of Justice has received an application for the pardon of Leonard Albertson, Walter Hoffman, and Bill Waterman, now in the penitentiary in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The men were concerned in the robbery of the United States mail at Steins Pass, New Mexico, in 1897, a crime in which Blackjack Ketchum, executed last Friday at Clayton, New Mexico, was implicated. A number of affidavits that the 3 men in question are innocent of the crime accompany the application. A letter was also received today, written by Blackjack just before his execution, exonerating them and implicating Dave Adkins, Ed Cullen, William Carver, Sam Ketchum, Bronco Bill, and himself. The papers have been referred back to the district attorney at New Mexico for examination and report. I never heard anything regarding the examination made by District Attorney W.B. Childress, and I am reasonably sure that he made none. It must have been in the summer of 1902 that my quarters at the prison carpenter shop were suddenly disrupted. I was requested by the acting superintendent not to enter the prison yard again. This order came about unexpectedly and in a somewhat startling manner. R.E. Garrett, acting superintendent, was seated in the main office at his desk near the front entrance. I had been occupied that morning, just across the hall, and about 9 a.m. I had gone through the main gate leading to the yard and shops and returned to the gate in not more than 15 minutes. "Unlock it, damn you, or I'll kill you," I heard a voice say just as I started to step into the superintendent's office. I retreated as three prisoners had a hold on him. All had huge knives, and one, a lifer, had his at Garrett's throat. My presence had startled them, and as they momentarily took their attention from him, he darted out of the entrance past me. Just as quickly, the lifer darted out and grabbed him and again demanded that he unlock the armory. Then I heard more voices and commands, and I saw more prisoners coming down a stairway with Mrs. Martin, Mrs. James, and Mrs. Burson. None of the guards in the front tower seemed aware of this commotion, and I ran over, waving wildly to attract their attention, pointing to the men trying to drag Mr. Garrett back inside. Instantly, they covered this group with their rifles, and Garrett shouted to me to tell them not to shoot. I yelled Garrett's command up to the Mexican guards, but only one of them could understand English. In the excitement, I couldn't utter a single Spanish syllable, although ordinarily I could speak the language very well. I rushed over to a saddled horse in front of the tower and headed for Santa Fe, a little over a mile away. I had to pass two of the guard towers, and although my horse was running his best, I took the safer method of lying down as much as possible to prevent them from shooting me off my horse. However, they seemed unaware of me. The horse was a fine little animal and covered the distance in a very short time, although about winded. I drew him to a halt in front of a large hardware store, shouting as loudly as possible, "There is a break at the prison. Arm yourselves and hurry. The prisoners are killing Garrett and the women." The Mexican village sprang instantly into action as men began milling from every direction, it seemed. Many rushed into the hardware store where they were supplied with guns and ammunition. I noticed a nice-looking team of bays hitched to a large spring wagon. I quickly dismounted and jumped into the seat, grabbed the reins, and shouted to those rushing out of the store to jump aboard. I don't believe it was more than 15 minutes before I returned with the armed men. Soon, the stretch of road was filled with buggies, wagons, men, horseback, and afoot. The prisoners had not yet succeeded in getting arms, and when they saw this mad rush of people, they suddenly surrendered and were glad to return within the walls. I went at once into the main office to see if the women folk and Garrett were injured. All were fine except that the ladies were pretty badly frightened. I was then told that Governor Otero wanted to see me at once. He expressed his gratitude for what I had done and promised to do all he could toward my release. As I said before, I was not permitted to again enter the prison yard as a safety precaution. But there was no need of this, as I retained the goodwill of nearly all of the prisoners, even those involved in the break. I was soon installed in the front office as assistant bookkeeper, where I remained for about five more months. Then one morning in early 1903, I was handed an official-looking envelope from Washington, D.C. It contained a pardon signed by President Theodore Roosevelt. Of course, we were all more than glad to be free again, with the restoration of all of our civil rights. But I am still undetermined as to why the pardon. Signed, W.C. Hovey, March 1934. After being freed, Hovey went to work in the railroad shop at Raton, New Mexico, and was later a fireman for the Santa Fe Railroad on the Florence Cripple Creek Run. Sometime later, he went to Panama as a steam shovel operator for the government when the Panama Canal was being built. He also went to Alaska as a steam shovel operator for the building of an Alaskan railroad. Eventually, he married and ran a garage and car rental service in Seattle, Washington. In his declining years in Portland, Oregon, he was determined to compile the story of his life, which he had entitled This Way But Once. It was never completed.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 30.